Today I want to talk to you of a greater marvel, the soul of man. My analysis of this soul, the human psyche, leads me to believe that man is not truly one, but truly two. One of him strives for the nobilities of life. This we call his good self. The other seeks an expression of impulses that bind him to some dim animal relation with the earth. This we may call the bad. These two carry on an eternal struggle in the nature of man. Yet they are chained together. And that chain spells repression to the evil, remorse to the good.
It's ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez.
I'm Drea Clark.
And I'm Samantha Ellis.
We are doing our own take on March Madness this month, ending the month looking at a film of Frederick March, most specifically 1931's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It's been a fair while since we've done a horror film.
It is.
Since Halloween.
Well, in this one, in rewatching it, it's legitimate scary in a good way.
I don't know if it's necessarily scary. It's definitely thirsty.
Oh, it's
oh my God.
100% the most sexually repressed thing I've ever seen in my life.
This is the horniest movie.
The entire movie is about the negative results of sexual repression. If you ask me. So yes, that comes first. Scares come second.
There's a really inappropriate joke I could have made off of all that dialogue that you just said, but I won't. Because we try to keep it a PG-13 show. We're talking about Frederick March. I was naturally ambivalent about talking about Frederick March on this podcast. Full disclosure, I hate Frederick March. I hate him.
Hate is such a strong word, Kristen.
Hate is a very strong word, but I have many, many reasons for why I hate him. A, if you recall a couple years ago, I'm actually going to try to pull it up because somebody's going to be like, where are your sources, Kristen? I have them.
You have the receipts.
I do have the receipts. I had read from WPR.org, this came out, I think, last year, where they were looking at University of Wisconsin-Madison.
My alma mater.
No way.
Yes. I'm interested to hear your story because my Frederick March thoughts are also based around my time in Madison.
They had found this University of Wisconsin-Madison history that they had with the Ku Klux Klan. And they found that there was a fraternity on campus that was affiliated with the KKK that Frederick March was a part of.
Uh-oh.
Great.
In doing my research about Frederick March, I read something similar to that, but what I read was that it was called the Ku Klux Klan, but it wasn't actually. It was something like they
were associated, not necessarily actively white supremacists.
What I read was that it wasn't even associated with white supremacy. It was they found their revolutionist ideas interesting. And basically, it was this group of students who wanted to make a change in their college. It was actually the best of the best students who were a part of this group, and they were willing to do radical things to make a change, is what I read.
Still sounds racist to me.
I don't know.
More compellingly, though, so that just added fuel to my Frederick March hate fire. The main reason I've always hated Frederick March is if anybody's read Veronica Lake's autobiography from the 70s, she talks about making I Married a Witch with Frederick March in 1942. She said that Frederick March slept with every leading lady that he ever worked with. He expected that. She told him she did not want to sleep with him, and so he proceeded to treat her like garbage. And so she decided to get the best of him by making his life a living hell. So if you watch the movie, when he's carrying her around. She has rocks in her jacket. There's a scene where she's slumped in a chair and he's leaning over her, but you can only see above his waist. She's kicking him in the junk. They despised each other. This was all before Me Too, so of course she just put up with it because she had no choice, but it's always led me to believe that Frederick March was just an entitled schmuck. I've never liked him. I like his movies, but him as a human being, I find reprehensible. I'm sorry to bring the mood down.
No, I actually find that whole thing hilarious. I know that he used to say that the movie should have been called I Married a Rhymes with Witch.
Keep in mind, I'll play devil's advocate as the resident Veronica Lake girl. He was not the only man that said she was a big pain to work with. Joel McRae said that as well. And from my research, Joel McRae wasn't a scumbag. God, I hope he wasn't a scumbag.
Please, let's not have Joel McRae be a scumbag. One guy.
There need to be at least one.
One very hot guy.
She was definitely troubled, but I choose to believe that women would not make up accusations about sexual harassment. But Samantha, you actually did the work for us of researching Frederick March.
I did.
What did you find out in your travels?
He was born Ernest Frederick McIntyre Bickle on August 31st, 1897 in Racine, Wisconsin, and served in World War I as an artillery lieutenant before starting out his life with the intention of becoming a banker. But at 23, he received an emergency appendectomy, which made him rethink his life and decide that he'd be happier as an actor. So in 1920, he shortened his mother's maiden name of Marcher to March and began working as an extra in New York, first appearing on Broadway in 1926 and securing a contract with Paramount in 1929. His career really took off from there. He received his first Oscar nomination in 1930 for his performance in The Royal Family of Broadway, in which he played a part based on John Barrymore, one of my favorite actors. 2 years later, he became the first actor to win the Oscar for Best Actor for a horror film, this one that we're discussing today, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And he held that record for 60 years until Anthony Hopkins took that from him for Silence of the Lambs. It was also considered the only Best Actor tie, and he tied with Wallace Beery for The Champ. Back then, if there was fewer than 3 votes difference, they would consider it a tie, but March actually won by a single vote. That didn't last for very long, actually, that rule. I find it really fascinating that there was anything even that close back then.
Well, I want to hear Drea's story. Because I want to know her Freddie March story, because I'm very interested.
I really wish it was, because it involved something really exciting, like a haunting or a visitation. But as we just said, we both went to the same university at slightly different times. When I was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, of course, worked and helped curate the arts, the little art house student cinema. And that name of that theater in our union is the Frederick March Play Circle. So I was constantly staring at his name, and I also lived in the little booth where you bought the tickets. So anyone who was watching those kinds of movies knew my face. And so I had people, I don't think they knew who he was, but they saw me sitting under that name all the time. So I would have people ask me, like, on campus, or if people were in lectures of mine, like, are you the Frederick March girl? And I was like, yes, that's me.
Oh my goodness, that's so cool.
Could be worse. And I will say, I did not know about the Klan elements at that time, but that also not just shames him, but my whole university. So thrilled to have that history. Real excited. Can't say I'm surprised, but what a rush. I found out about him and looked into him again because of being the Frederick March girl. It's like, oh, I should probably know some about this guy. It was a really interesting sideways into finding his work. Strangely, I Married a Witch was the first thing that I watched. And I really hope we can discuss for even an element of time that we call it the way that we think of it, which is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But everyone in the film calls him Jekyll. And it drove me bonkers when I was rewatching it. Did that stand out to you guys?
It's the Dr. Frankenstein of this movie. Don't lie to me. It's Jekyll, okay? You can class it up all you want, Ernest Bickle, but I know your real colors.
Exactly.
I've always wondered why they pronounced it that way, because in every other adaptation, it's Jekyll. They never really explain it.
No.
I'm assuming it's just to class it up. I really do. I think it's just a snooty way of trying to glamorize it.
It's a choice. At least it's consistent.
I have seen several Frederick March movies. For somebody who hates him, I actually see a lot of the films he's done, particularly a lot of his pre-codes. And I do, like, not in a similar way as pre-code Clark Gable, which is my favorite pre-code leading man, but in that similar way, I think Frederick March really transformed into something different after the code took effect. So if you watch something like this, or even something like Smiling Through, which I recommend everybody watch Smiling Through. It is the weirdest paranormal resurrection romantic drama that you can watch. It is incredibly bizarre, but it's really good. I feel that Frederick March, now knowing what we know about him, really perpetuated himself as this, like, dude who oozed sexuality. Ladies are just throwing themselves on him. It's just really weird watching this and watching something like Smiling Through, even something like Mary of Scotland, which is a later film. It's after The Code, but he always played these non-threatening ladies' men, which I found to be very weird. Even something like I Married a Witch, Veronica Lake and Susan Hayward are fighting over him, although in that film, he's a bit of a doormat. Even in something like Nothing Sacred, I think there's a softening of his persona. It's very weird to me to watch this and then his later films.
I agree. I think you just said something about his non-threatening attractiveness. And it's actually one of the reasons this film, Jekyll and Hyde, works so well and is also a testament to the incredible performance he's giving, is there is such a disparity between his Jekyll and Hyde, more so than just the makeup. And it was funny because when he's in full Dr. Jekyll handsomeness, this time I was watching it with my sort of contemporary eyes and I was like, oh, he is a blend of Sebastian Stan and Dan Stevens, and I don't hate that. I really liked that. And actually even both of those actors fit that non-threatening attractiveness. But his urbaneness as Jekyll, and you very much believe how forthright he is and his sense of goodness. You know, he's got a little mirth to him. He's a fully robust character. And yet when he goes to Hyde, the villain of these kinds of pieces, which is like a monster movie in a lot of ways, is often relegated to just being very one note. But Hyde has some real interesting complexities to him. Frederick March handles both of those characters really well. It calls upon him to be a physical actor. It calls upon interpersonal relationships. He has different reactions he's inspiring in people. He earned his shared Oscar.
Technically, he won it. He won it by one vote, so it's his.
I agree with everyone who voted for him.
I definitely wouldn't give any Oscar to Wallace Beery. I haven't seen The Champ, but...
Well, before we get into this, you should have probably read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde at some point, but if you haven't, it tells the story of a Victorian era scientist played by Frederick March who is doing experiments and ends up taking a potion that transforms him into this animalistic persona named Mr. Hyde, who ends up forming a relationship with she's a prostitute named Ivy Pearson, played by Miriam Hopkins. Well, at the same time, Henry Jekyll just wants to marry the sweet and simple Muriel, played by Rose Hobart. That is literally the plot of this movie. I have seen this film at least 3 times, and it never ceases to amaze me that the entire conceit of this film is that this guy just wants to get laid. He wants to marry Muriel, darn it, and her dad's like, no, tradition, you guys have to wait. I think he says 8 months, but yeah, they act like 20 years. Actually takes Muriel away. They go out of town to London to keep her away from this man who just wants to marry her. So that compels Jekyll to essentially unleash his kinky side and find a lady who's willing to get down to business with him. This is essentially if Splendor in the Grass was a dark, frightening film, more than that movie already is, actually.
It's interesting you say that, because my real only narrative question with this film, and it's also because, humble brag, I did read the Robert Louis Stevenson, right? I did read the original story, and then I've seen the Spencer Tracy as well. I have not seen the John Barrymore.
I haven't seen the Spencer Tracy one, though, so.
Okay, I have a lot of facts on the John Barrymore one. I just haven't seen it. My question for this, like I said, my narrative question is, they all vary a little. In this one, his impetus to make this potion, the filmmaking in this stands out. I mean, in 1931, the camera work they're doing is so fluid and constantly moving. There's such a beautiful look to it. But it also keeps employing this really unique device, which is how it opens the film, which is total POV from Jekyll's eyes. You're seeing what he sees, which means you're seeing how the world sees him. And he's met with the admiration and the pleasantness. It's clear the people who work for him and then his colleagues, the woman in his life, like he is looked at in this very admirable way that you think would lead to a contentedness in his character. And yet the first scene we're getting is him as a scientist talking about the duality of man and that there's a good and an evil in each of them. Kristen, you read that it was largely him wanting to dig into the evil in himself as maybe even a release because he was not getting said release from Sweet Muriel. It's laid out with enough complexity that I wasn't entirely sure if it was just that, because I did have enough faith in him as a scientist and as someone who was wanting to unlock this. Was it that he was trying to release that so he could live out evil thoughts and actions that he was thinking of? Or was he trying to curb them by drinking this and maybe just becoming only the good parts of himself?
I'm not 100% certain on this, but I want to say this movie was released right around the time that Freud was releasing his writings and had come up with the concept of the id and the superego, the whole man releasing his darker impulses, playing God. That's the interpretation this movie wants to go in, which is that man by nature is dual, that there is always this primitive missing link animalistic side to him that we need to indulge. And it goes back to Freud, the God syndrome. That's how I interpret it.
Number one, it seems like this is a bit of a trend for Friedrich March, just comparing this to, say, I Married a Witch. He plays in both of those very repressed, organized, boring, for lack of a better word, people. And they're engaged to the equally boring brunette. And then they have this awakening within themselves, hey, I don't want to be stuck in this kind of a life anymore, and go for this interesting exotic blonde. So they have a lot in common. There's a little bit of both, a little bit of what Kristen's saying, a little bit of what Dre is saying, in that, yeah, a lot of it's due to sexual frustration. He even says a few times that he wants to get rid of the bad completely. I think he wants to sort of live that out as a fantasy a little bit for a little while and then get rid of it so he can marry Muriel and move on with his life without being tempted by anything.
It shows the heights that man has to achieve societally in order to be respected. So this movie starts out with us seeing Dr. Jekyll's day to day. He's pretty much presented as a saint to the fact that he helps handicapped children learn to walk again, which I always find very hilarious, that POV shot of that girl who obviously knows how to walk, throwing her hands around and pretending like she's struggling, saying, thank you, sir, thank you.
That whole part reminds me of Boris Karloff in Corridors of Blood. I don't know if you've seen that, but very similar. It's just another goody two-shoes doctor who's experimenting with some weird stuff, who you see how good of a person he is by helping the poor with their medicine needs.
The girl has Clara syndrome, if anybody's seen Heidi.
No, I haven't.
Heidi's the delightful story of how a young girl's love helps another girl who obviously has psychosomatic paraplegia learn how to walk again. He's presented as the saintly figure, but at the same time, that man's got urges. So, like, he goes to the bad side of town and saves a benevolent prostitute, has to, like, keep it all inside. He can't be with her because that would be wrong societally. He wants to be able to have sex, for lack of a better word, with the respectable girl, but he can't do that and still be perceived as a good man. So what does he do? He has to find an outlet for the slutty side of him. It's very weird to see a movie about the Madonna whore complex of masculinity that goes towards the presentation of Ivy, who could very easily have been this one-note, stereotypical hooker with a heart of gold character, but she really is not judged for her actions. She ends up being the real scene stealer of the movie because the movie condemns Hyde for how he treats her instead of taking his side that, oh, she's just trash. So it's really unique to see a movie about the role that sexuality has on masculinity and how societally during that time period, ain't nobody having sex without being judged for it.
The handling of Ivy's character surprised me with how sympathetic it was to her, and not just in the casual damsel in distress, women are incapable. The film actually acknowledges that she is not able to protect herself financially because of class, because of her gender. You know, that the landlady is also aware of that, that she is at the mercy of this man because of her station. And we are, like you said, sympathetic and not judgmental to her because of that. Because there is always, especially with sex worker characters, this easily written off. And of course she is killed, but with some heart distressing what she's going through. He's beating her. He is a nightmare, and they concentrate on that. And they don't try and shame the victim, literally shame the victim as well. It's just about the pure horrors of his, would we count that as that's his unleashed toxic masculinity? It's nothing but entitlement and grabbiness. Yes. And visceral disgustingness. That's a term people use, right?
And to go off of that, I love Miriam Hopkins. She was a woman who was one of several labeled difficult in the pain, but I love her. And I think what this movie does, that the later version, the 41 version, which I have not seen, I've caught snippets of it. The Ivy character in that film is Ingrid Bergman.
Which makes no sense. I haven't seen it, but it makes no sense.
If you're looking at just the role of persona, that couldn't be more different. Because this is pre-code. Miriam Hopkins was definitely known in the 30s as a more sexually liberated woman. She played numerous characters like that, whether it's Trouble in Paradise or Designed for Living. She was a woman that had sex, and you knew that. By the 40s, though, we present Ivy Pearson as a very tragic figure. Pretty clean Ingrid Bergman. And this is a movie that has Lana Turner in it.
If I may chime in, Bergman was actually originally cast as the fiance love interest, and she lobbied to be able to play Ivy instead because it's a more interesting character and because she herself was afraid of being typecast. Victor Fleming, he was worried and concerned about that for obvious reasons. If you have Ingrid Bergman and Lana Turner and these two characters, Bergman apparently did a screen test that satisfied him, at least, so they switched it. For an actress like her, I can definitely see where there's so much more with Ivy than with Muriel's. It makes sense that it's not the casting you would assume, and the filmmakers also did not initially assume that either.
But I think it's impossible not to note that there's been a change in the presentation. Ivy here, her introduction is probably the most lascivious part of this movie. Frederick March swoops in and saves her. She grabs his hand and puts it between her thighs. The camera's like right there. She takes her top off and is embracing him, and you get side boob. I was like, this is 1931, people. I get nervous every time I see Claudette Colbert in The Sign of the Cross. You forget how permissive before the code was enforced.
this is the first Miriam Hopkins film that I've seen, the only one. And
You are missing out.
I know. That's the thing. I have always heard about her, but just looking at pictures here and there, I didn't think that she would be very interesting to watch, and I couldn't have been more wrong. And this is only after seeing the John Barrymore version, the 1920 version, but I think what really sets this movie apart, I don't even really want to say Friedrich March. I would think Ivy is the best part of this movie, without a doubt. Probably the best part of any version.
You are correct.
You mentioned the side boob. You mentioned that really sexy introduction. But she has really obvious cleavage throughout the whole film. And that's something that kind of took as well. I loved her costume. And she was so sympathetic. I loved it. I loved her. Her performance was so fantastic. It was more than just scene stealing. She was who I wanted to see.
I totally forgot watching it this time how, A, it's evident that she's not wearing a bra. And B, just how low the tops go. Again, all of that would be changed in just a couple of years after this movie. I know we praise, and we'll talk about the makeup effects in a second, the transformation sequence that Friedrich March undergoes. But I think the physical transformation that Ivy undergoes as well is very telling. You know, you see her in the beginning, she's this bright, sparkling thing with shining eyes and this sweet little smile. And I love there are so many Miriam Hopkinisms in this movie. Like the introduction where she says, "He kicked me in the ribs, I'm going to faint." And then she delicately places herself on the pillow. That's a Miriam Hopkins thing, and I love it. Even though she's got scarlet letter Cockney accent going on in this movie. After she encounters Hyde at the club and she's spending time with him, you see the dark circles under her eyes. She's just acting like a terrified child. She's being terrorized by this guy. When she finally shows up at Jekyll's house to plead for her life, the physical burden, the toll that this movie takes on her is just so intense. And you feel it. You see that transition in a way that's different than Jekyll's transition into Hyde, because that's prolonged,
right?
But it's an overt transition. Hers is one that gradually builds throughout the entirety of the film.
It's such an accurate and realistic description of an abusive relationship. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen one, especially from this time period, that's so real and so raw, and you just feel for her 100%. And it makes you wonder, was there any way she could have prevented this? Because he really forced himself into her life as Hyde.
That's a nice entry for her as well, and another way that the film does right by her. Because if they had set up more of an implication that she was like a gold digger or trying to get something out of him, it would have put a darker cast on her. From the second that they are interacting when he comes into the club, she's performing for the other gentleman and she's doing her song. When she does the second rendition of that song, it is so truly heartbreaking to me.
That's one of the parts that really sticks out to me in that film.
Great, terrible moment. But then we see him and he is pulling her to a table with him, forcing her to drink with him. It is very much, she is at his mercy. So that's why I bring up the class of it. Above and beyond the gender, that she's not really given an out. To me, it made total sense that she would need to go with him wherever he was saying they were going next, because that is the society they're in, the moment of time. If that man decides that he wants that class of woman, then he gets her. And I really like, Samantha, what you said about this film also taking on the arc of an abusive relationship, because it absolutely is. And it's so prolonged. Normally, you would think that the moments of like the villain and the streetwalker, it's just going to be like a quick exchange and then a bloody kill. Do you know what I mean? And this is like drawn out so that you get this idea that it is not just a physical threat and violence that he's bringing to her, but he's manipulating her. He is messing with her head. He's gaslighting her. There's a lot going on with it, and the fact that they spent that time building it up is one of the complexities that I think makes this still such a strong viewing today.
This movie really plays, without making it explicit, not just physical violence, but sexual violence. I think it's worth pointing out that this movie introduces, when Ivy and Dr. Jekyll meet, she's willing to sleep with him consensually. She does the leg thing with the garters and the comeback soon. You know, she's more than willing to have this relationship with him. And yet when Hyde shows up, he demands it. And there is this unescapable aura of sexual perversion, possibly even rape, without calling to it. She is terrified, not just of something physical, but you get the feeling that it goes beyond that, that it's inescapable, that this is probably a relationship surrounded around rape. And so I think that that's really, really telling in 1931. And keep in mind, Miriam Hopkins would actually play one of the earliest depictions of rape, which is the story of Temple Drake. That's the most heartbreaking crux of this movie, is how it ends up perverting sexuality.
The inclusion of all of that. And like you just said, when we initially talked about why is Dr. Jekyll going through with this experiment, and if it's just for him to release or assume his negative carnal side, the fact of the matter is, if as a good man, he very much, very easily could have had a very comfortable affair with Ivy. I keep saying the word complexities, but it's so nice how many shades they give to these characters. He had a physical outlet, a sexual outlet, if he wanted it, a willing one. It makes his decision as a scientist, as a man, as whatever, to take this potion and see what it does. I mean, he goes so far to leave a suicide note because he doesn't know what this thing's going to do to him. Such nice, murky waters they're playing with.
I think another thing, too, that's so sad about this, I mean, there's so many heartbreaking aspects to Ivy and her relationship with Hyde, but I think even more sad is her relationship with Dr. Jekyll, because over time, she genuinely has feelings for him. She wants to be with him. And like you said, Drea, it's the class that separates them. I would have loved to see what could have happened if he and Ivy did have some kind of affair, or if they were even able to have an organic relationship. I think it would have been much more interesting than his relationship with Muriel, which we don't really see built upon. But it's just so sad that she loves him and thinks so highly of Dr. Jekyll, but at the same time, it's him that's abusing her and she doesn't know it.
Which makes that reveal to her all the more terrifying. Absolutely. When Hyde says that it is him. Drea, you brought up the different incarnations of the Hyde character and looking at them in different guises. Here, we've seen this story told numerous times, and even in the more comedic vein, something like The Absent-Minded or Nutty Professor. This incarnation, you definitely get Hyde as being indicative of the missing link. He's very ape-like with the Neanderthal brow and the hair and the overpronounced teeth. I know I've read numerous texts about how there's a racist component to how he's supposed to look like a monkey and what that says about people of color in the early 30s. The Hyde character is definitely representative of this grotesque other, everything that is subversive and primitive. The whole concept of Jekyll and Hyde as a Victorian novel is about man's ability to be refined, proof that we have evolved, that we have become cultured. For the Hyde character, he's uncivilized. Nobody wants to hang out with him. He's not illustrative of the Victorian world, which we are supposed to see as this cleaner, brighter, more progressive place. In the Barrymore version, he's also monstrous. Although I think that take is more fantasy-based. It's been a long time since I've seen the Barrymore ones.
See, comparing the three, and I haven't seen the 41 version, but I know what Spencer Tracy looks like because I was actually curious enough to look it up while I was watching this film, too. But if you compare the three, I would say John Barrymore is just a grotesque, ugly man. But he's still obviously supposed to be a man. While as Friedrich March's version is, like you said, animalistic. He is not supposed to even look human. Spencer Tracy, he just puts on a crazy face. There's really minimal makeup involved compared to the other two, which I find interesting.
He looks a bit more gargoyle-y. He just looks like Spencer Tracy on a bender.
Exactly, like if he had a lost weekend.
As if Spencer Tracy ever went on a bender.
Of course not.
Here is the Driven Soul.
Dre, did you find anything about the different versions of Hyde?
I did. And I agree. The John Barrymore Hyde has a much more classical, it reminded me like of a gothic bad guy. There wasn't a full Nostradamus look to him. It starts to elongate his skull and his hair becomes stringy, but it was much more Nosferatu, things that scare you. Like, oh, let's make him craggly and stuff. Wally Westmore did the makeup for this version. The Westmores obviously are now like a fourth generation makeup family. Wally Westmore was one of six Westmore brothers who got into it. This was first notable films. He did so many huge films. He did Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard, Place in the Sun, Greatest Show on Earth, Roman Holiday, To Catch a Thief, Breakfast at Tiffany's. I mean, the amount of things this man worked on blows the mind. If you just watched Wally Westmore's films, you would have a solid classic film education. Like, you can see, even see from those films, there's a lot of different types of makeup that he would do. And this one was one of the most inventive and I think one of the most known for. I have not read what Kristen was remarking about. It makes sense to me, the idea of racial strife over what the Hyde makeup looks like in this version, because it is really simian based. And unfortunately, especially at that time, racially negative caricatures were done with implications asserting black actors or black Americans in general with simian features. I can't touch that because I don't know a lot about it, but I can absolutely see where they're coming from. And I'm sure there's a very good think piece about that somewhere. But just on Westmore's creation, one of the things that's amazing about this, and I will say, like I was talking to about the POV camera work that we get, and they go back to it a few times. There's a couple constructs they use with the camera that I really like that they return to. And the POV one is the big. The very first time we see him turn into Hyde, it's noticeable, for admirable for several reasons, but one of them is because in modern day eyes, it's not as impressive, but especially then, it is one shot direct to camera with Freddy staring at the camera and turning before our eyes from Jekyll, polished, handsome man to Hyde, this creature, pronounced teeth and this brow. Apparently the director held this for decades. He kept it a secret forever until he finally wrote about it. March was wearing makeup with these different contrasting colors, and then they had different filters running against the colors, so they corresponded. And when the filter was there, you wouldn't see that color. And then when it moved, the color revealed. And since it's black and white films, the colors weren't there on their own. So it was just very inventive for the time, and to me, very effective. There was something about watching him transform all in one long shot that feels so exciting. Such a great movie moment.
What it reminds me of, to go with a later film that I'm assuming had to homage it, if anybody's seen American Werewolf in London,
yeah,
I feel like that is almost directly inspired by this, because this movie, when the transformation happens, it looks like it hurts. It definitely feels like this long, drawn-out, painful process. Unlike, you know, other movies where it's just like they fall down and then they pops back up and that's who he is. Definitely appreciated the concept of he's giving up a piece of himself every single time he does this. I know a lot of Jekyll and Hyde narratives tend to be almost addiction narratives in terms of him being compelled to go back. This movie doesn't necessarily go that far. I was never really clear about whether he was compelled to go back to Hyde himself or if Hyde was slowly starting to take over. I would say that at the end, considering how he turns back very quickly when the police are chasing him and then says, oh, he went out that way, that he is culpable in knowing what he's doing.
I thought there was a nice ambiguity to it. I think it wasn't that it wasn't clear in the storytelling, but that he doesn't know. There are definitely times when he's sitting in the park and he's meant to be meeting Muriel for dinner and they're going to announce their engagement. It's like you watch him feel Hyde coming on and he's horrified at the prospect. So there's definitely times when it seems out of his control. Because of that, there's also ambiguity to how much does he remember? Does he remember everything from when he was Hyde? Does he only remember part of it? And likewise, when he's Hyde, does he remember everything from Jekyll? And I love having questions in there because it's such a fun thing to try and puzzle out as you're watching.
The Barrymore version goes into detail about that more, what he remembers from being Hyde and what he doesn't. But I agree. I feel like he wants to stop turning into Hyde after Ivy essentially begs him not to, even though she doesn't know that she's begging him not to. Once he makes that promise to Ivy, I think he has hung up the cape, given it up for good. But that's when Hyde takes over and he can't help it anymore. That was my take on it.
You saying that? Yes, I agree.
Thank you.
We have had Jekyll and Hyde stories, not necessarily on the big screen in a way that's not terrible. I want to say the last Jekyll and Hyde I saw was League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah, where they presented Hyde as like this big hulking behemoth. That's a terrible movie. Don't watch it.
Definitely don't.
I know that when I saw the Broadway show, there's a Broadway adaptation of musical, which I'm very surprised that no one's attempted to make. But the Hyde there is almost like this suave, definitely kinky dick. Jekyll is like this smart, mild-mannered guy, and then you have Hyde as like this just total like toxic masculinity. They've talked about redoing Jekyll and Hyde. I want to say Keanu Reeves contemplated doing it a couple years ago, maybe a decade ago. I'd love to see them redo this because I think the state of masculinity is both changed and not changed. That this would be fascinating. And I know Drea brought up Sebastian Stan. I can see that. I can see him doing this. I always say, and most people are going to roll their eyes when I say it, I see Armie Hammer in everything. I think he'd be fantastic.
I completely agree with you, Kristen. I would say...
He's very modern day Frederick March.
Every time I think of recasting a classic film, my mind always goes to Armie Hammer. Armie Hammer for Tony Curtis. Armie Hammer for... Army Hammer for Cary Grant, Army Hammer for everything.
It's because he looks like he'd be comfortable in an ascot and loafers with no socks.
It's so true.
Oh my god, yes.
That would be my choice as well.
I know, what was it, the Dark Universe? Universal talked about doing a version of this a couple years ago before Tom Cruise ruined everything with the Mummy remake. I don't want that version. I want like a new version.
I know they're redoing The Invisible Man through Blumhouse. Can we talk about the ending? Because the one big question I had, and especially since you guys are familiar with the Barrymore version, in what I was reading about and in the original, the deaths start piling up, his terrible deeds. In the Frederick March version, he's taken this singer, street worker hostage, essentially. He's sexually abused her. He's manipulated her. And then he's killed her. Finally, he goes and inadvertently or not, in turning to Hyde, he attacks both his betrothed and then kills her father. In the original, when he goes back and he senses Hyde coming back on again, he commits suicide. In the, I say original, but I'm meaning the 1920 version. And then in this one, he's fighting it till the very end, and they kill him. They kill him when he's in the Hyde format. He turns back to Jekyll in death. And I think it is such an interesting decision, because the suicide of it, right, is, it gives you, again, a sort of insight to his mindset. And it's the reverse of that. We get an insight to his mindset and that he doesn't try and stop himself. And I found that fascinating.
It was the only logical way that they would have included it. I thought of it was more like a death by cop type of thing. But here, at least, March goes out swinging. We talk about ambiguity, but his character does knowingly transform, or at least imply that it's knowingly, and then decides he's still going to try to get out of it. I think it's a more active death.
By that point, it's hard to say, because it's clear that he cares about his own life and his own safety above all else. I think it's just his own fear of mortality. I don't know if I would say that's Hyde talking or him talking, but it's clear that he's changed so much from the beginning of the film to that. I don't think the Jekyll from the beginning would ever have tried to save himself to that degree.
Right, and it's such a great counterpoint. His process as Hyde begins with him writing the suicide note, right? And so to end with someone who is not only like, oh no, I'm not taking myself out of this, like I'm literally going down swinging, it's such a testimonial to his changing mindset. One of you just said something that reminded me. The Hyde makeup becomes more pronounced every time he transforms, and the Jekyll looks more exhausted and tired. Watching how those characters, the different parts of man, start factoring into each other's lives so that they're blurring those lines more and more the more they change, and what that means for his final decisions and his final actions. It's saying a lot about how all of the repressed negativity in us could probably easily overpower our goodness. Not a super optimistic about the human condition take.
This whole plan of his really backfired. He went into it hoping that he would be able to separate the two, the good and the bad sides, in order to get rid of the bad. But it turns out that the bad is the dominant and what took over in the end.
In comparison to other scientists in the universal canon, what you look at Colin Clive in Frankenstein, the Bride of Frankenstein, or the scientist in The Mummy, because all of these were under the same studio. March's portrayal of Jekyll is definitely the more nihilistic. Colin Clive as Frankenstein himself definitely had a god complex, but it's never threatening in the sense that he intentionally seeks to harm others. If anything, he self-exiles himself in order to devote everything day and night to the creation of the creature.
And that's basically the whole point of the sequel. He doesn't want to harm anyone, so he wants nothing to do with creating another one.
So this definitely has a more dark, cynical look at science, I think, more than anything else.
Oh, I like that. Especially like you're saying, the Freud publications you were talking about, I think, are sort of the mid-20s. And there is this funny kickback that came that science was looped in with sort of psychoanalysis in a lot of ways. Like people were not real happy with what was being revealed. And I really like the idea of this film being a treatise on, and this is why you shouldn't research for answers.
This is why science is bad, kids.
Let's just leave things as they are.
I do recommend it. I think the reason why it's not as well remembered in comparison to Frankenstein or Bride of Frankenstein is A, the lack of a really bankable monster. Considering how many different interpretations of Jekyll and Hyde we've gotten, he's not as immediately recognizable in terms of having an aesthetic look as something like the creature from the Black Lagoon or Frankenstein's monster or something like that.
Exactly.
Also, while this movie suffers from being made in 31, it's still got that choppy, jumpy type of acting to it. The characters are overly florid. The dialogue's a bit stilted and formalistic. It almost feels like these are play actors on a stage reciting Shakespearean lines, but that is just the sad fact of making a movie with talking being a relatively new invention. But overall, I do really enjoy this movie, if only for Miriam Hopkins's performance, which is utterly compelling. Freddie March and I don't get along, but I do think he's really good in this movie. And again, I've seen several of his movies. When we read the listener comments, you'll be surprised how many of those movies I've actually seen. I thoroughly recommend it. I think it's one of the forgotten Universal horror movies. Drea, what did you think of it overall?
Well, first off, Kristen, I don't think anyone's going to ever be surprised that you've actually seen something because you've seen everything.
I did wait 30 years to see Citizen Kane.
Okay, fair. I really liked this, and I really liked revisiting it with an eye towards the technical elements of it. How it's shot is truly impressive. It's something if I was looking at an up-and-coming filmmaker now. The camera is roving constantly, so there's these really long takes with a lot of dialogue, and the camera moves so much that the composition is also changing. So even though you're in one take, which allows for that conversational feel, it looks different from moment to moment, and it's really hard to do that. So there were a lot of things I enjoyed. There's also some really nice. In addition to that POV that I kept mentioning, there's three or four usages of this split screen that's often showing you the two women in one screen and giving you an idea of their juxtaposing lives or some contradictory information. But I really liked that. I like a film that's trying to tell me a lot of information in different ways and then leave some interesting questions, thought provocations. So I really like this film. It stood up better as a gothic horror piece. It's not a slasher by any means, but I do think it has a nice darkness to it that I have overlooked in my years of, especially around Halloween, like revisiting my favorite creepsters. I'm going to have to throw this back in the fire. Old Freddy March, my sometimes namesake. Nice getting a handle on him in this because I think he did a great job.
Samantha, what about you? What do you think overall about Jekyll and Hyde?
Honestly, I don't think I'm going too far when I say that this is the best version. The first version is still a little primitive, although John Barrymore is one of my favorite actors. It's really hard to top that. And then, of course, the 41 version, I haven't seen it, but it's not looking so good yet. Honestly, I love this movie. The inclusion of Ivy is what makes it great. If we're talking about our favorite shots, I think my favorite shot would definitely be the moment. It's so iconic to me in horror now when Ivy is sort of celebrating the exit of Hyde in the mirror with toasting to herself like, yay, he's gone. And then she sees him in the reflection of the mirror. I think that shot is so genius. And it's my favorite part of the whole movie. It's my favorite version of this film for sure.
Let us know your thoughts on Jekyll and Hyde, Frederick March, any of it. You can tell us at ticklishbiz@gmail.com and we'll read them on the next episode. We do have some listener messages that came in. I asked on Twitter about everybody's favorite Freddie March movie, and we got some very unique responses. TCM Party at TCM _party, the amazing folks over there, had mentioned right off the top of my head, I Married a Witch, Best Years of Our Lives, and Middle of the Night. I have seen two of those movies. Best Years of Our Lives is a fantastic movie. I would love to do it at some point. The problem is it's really long.
I still haven't seen it. I'm terrible. I need to see it. Everyone has been telling me I need to see it.
When somebody asks me about the best portrayal of disability, it's my go-to movie.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Sad that it's a movie from 1941. It's the best disability. But Frederick March is actually really good in it. And of course, we all know I love I Married a Witch.
You can't go wrong with I Married a Witch. I think it's probably my favorite on top of A Star is Born. That's my favorite version of A Star is Born.
James Downs at James_Al_Downs says, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and I Married a Witch. Any love here for Mary of Scotland?
Cricket.
As the Tudor nerd, Mary of Scotland is a very, very Hollywood version of that film. I have a lot of issues with it, predominantly the fact that Katharine Hepburn talks like Katharine Hepburn and she's supposed to be playing an English woman. Frederick March is pretty good. I think he plays Darnley. There is a scene where he's supposed to be flashing a fireplace where he's like wearing a kilt and he lifts the back of the kilt up to like warm his rump. Like the most distinctive part of the movie.
That sounds so silly.
Christine at Gloria DeHavens says, I like A Star is Born, but my favorite movie of his is Merrily We Go to Hell. He plays an alcoholic in this movie too, but this time he shares the screen with Sylvia Sidney, and they make a lovely pair. That is actually playing at the TCM Classic Film Festival this year.
If there was nothing competing against it, I would definitely see it, but I believe that slot, I'm probably watching The Clock, even though High Society is in my top five favorite movies, so that's a tough one.
Oh, you and I are going to fight over High Society if we ever get to it.
it's so up there for me.
I'm going to try to go to that one. Maddie Loves Her Classic Films at Maddie Loves Her C1 says, I Married a Witch and Middle of the Night. He breaks my heart in Middle of the Night. One of the best actors of all time. I need to see this movie. I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, I need too. I really want to see more of his pre-code. Definitely Smiling Through is probably number one on my list.
Smiling Through is, again, I cannot stress this, one of the weirdest movies. And it's got two people I hate. It's got Frederick March and Leslie Howard.
I was going to say, if you say Norma Shearer, we're going to have some problems.
Despise Norma. I don't love her, but I know
love her. I understand that she's overdramatic, but I love her.
Jay Olek at Unkazaki says, the best years of our lives should be a Veterans Memorial Day. What It's a Wonderful Life is to Christmas. I think Harold Russell stole the show, but March, Myrna Loy, Wright, and Michael Hall all seem like a real family. He plays the comedy and the drama both brilliantly. Peter Bryant at PM Bryant says, Design for Living, which I just saw for the first time quite recently, is definitely my favorite. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is a tremendous film, but too dark to be one of my favorites. Design for Living is really good. If you want to see the complete 180 from this in a movie where he's also with Miriam Hopkins, in a movie that's also incredibly kinky, you should go watch that because it's a delightful story about Frederick March, Miriam Hopkins, and Gary Cooper, like a thruple.
Oh my goodness. That is all I need to hear. I am on that.
It's very good. And then Christiane Young at Chris Opera 1 says, the best years of our lives, one of the true masterpieces of the golden age, and March's homecoming scene could squeeze tears out of diamonds. I think we have a consensus on what Frederick March movie is the best. It's the best years of our lives. I would agree with that. I actually have no disagreement there. You can email us what your favorite Frederick March movie is, and we'll read them on a future episode. Drea actually had to leave, but you can check out her work and follow her on Twitter at TheDreaClark. Sam, what's going on with you and where can fans find and get in touch with you?
Well, as always, I am blogging on musingsofaclassicfilmaddict.com. I'll be posting my TCM Film Festival schedule there shortly. And I'll also be sending my Cooking with the Stars posts every month to Classic Movie Hub. And you can follow me on Twitter at Classic Film Geek.
Awesome. That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a variety of different ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, wherever podcasts are available, Stitcher Radio, Player FM, Spotify, or iTunes. If you're listening via iTunes, help us out. Leave us a rating and a review. As always, you can contact us directly with questions, comments, suggestions at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com. And you can visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, which is journeysinclassicfilm.com. I actually just posted a tour of the Walt Disney Studios that I took, as well as a bunch of movie reviews and interview with author David Thompson. And my TCM Classic Film Festival lineup is going to be on there in the coming days. And the podcast is also on Twitter if you want to send us your tweets at ticklish_biz. If you want to learn more about upcoming episodes, hear exclusive content before anyone else, and get merch, consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. We have a wealth of amazing perks. All your donations go straight back into making Ticklish Business the classic film podcast that it is. If you become a patron right now, you can get an official Ticklish Business button. They are delightfully misspelled, but they are official. The first wave went out to all the patrons today, so you guys should be getting them. If you're coming to the TCM Classic Film Festival and you want a button, I will have plenty on hand. Better yet, if you say that you listen to the podcast and or have an original button that I've already sent you, you can get an official exclusive button that I have made that's a totally different one. I'll be giving those out to people at the festival as well. So all you have to do is start a donation to just $1 if you want to get a button. You can also get access to our exclusive content that we have, my supplemental shows. William Bibbiani and I look at how Hollywood talks about itself with Based on a True Podcast. Adam Kautzer and I talk about the films Hollywood enjoys remaking again and again with doubled features. We're also going to be sharing our TCM Classic film content. That's going to be there before anybody else can listen to it. So you can check out that at patreon.com/ticklishbiz. And if you want to learn more about the stars turning 100, we're not talking about them this year on the show, but at TCM Backlot, I'm continuing my centennial celebration, looking at the stars turning 100 in 2019. For March, I'm honoring actress Jennifer Jones, and April is actor Howard Keel. You can find those at TCM Backlot. Next time, we are going to be talking all things TCM Classic Film Festival. We're going to be sharing our picks, talking about tips and tricks to get the most out of your film festival. So we're going to be taking questions. If you have questions that you ever wanted answered about the festival or TCM, or you just want to ask us something, this is going to be a makeshift episode / mailbag. So definitely send us your questions about the TCM Film Festival as we talk about all the things we're excited to experience there this year. That will be next episode. Till then.